It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. When metal and thrash bands like Lamb of God play, the mosh pit in front of the stage looks like a whirlpool of aggression. Mostly young men slam about, some jump the stage and dive off. Bumps and bruises and even cuts aren't that uncommon. As Lamb of God singer D. Randall Bly learned at one show, a tragic accident made things much worse. In June of 2012, as Lamb of God arrived in Prague for a concert, Bly was detained and arrested for manslaughter. He was taken to Pankrat Prison, a place where the Nazis' torture units had set up camp during World War II. Bly was accused of pushing a young fan off the stage 2 years earlier at a show. 19-year-old Daniel Nozek had died at that show. Bly was leveled with a charge equal to manslaughter. The surprise arrest led to quite an ordeal for the singer. He writes about it in a memoir called Dark Days, and he joins us now to talk about it. Randy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
When did you first hear about the death of this fan, Daniel Nozek?
At the Prague International Airport. You know, I came off an airplane. It was in 2012. We had played in Prague 2 years previously in the summer of 2010. We had no idea that anyone had been hurt or anything. So it took us 2 years because we're touring all around, but we booked another show in Prague. And then we showed up in 2012 in the summer, I believe it was in June, and got off the end of this airplane. And there were what looked like a SWAT team there. And I thought, ooh, someone's in trouble. Of course, I didn't think it was me. And I got to the end of the runway, and these people, they were five guys with machine guns and masks and three big plainclothes, like severe Soviet haircut-looking dudes, turned out to be plainclothes detectives, and then a woman who turned out to be the head detective in the case. She handed me a piece of paper and said I was being charged with manslaughter in the connection of a death of a fan for my show 2 years previously. So it's completely out of the blue. No idea any of this had happened.
When that happened, what went through your mind immediately? Do you think, well, this is just some kind of mistake? How long did it take you to let it sink in that this is really, that you could have potentially been in some serious trouble?
Well, generally when there's guys with machine guns and masks and they put you in handcuffs, it sinks in pretty quickly that you're in serious trouble. It sinks in pretty rapidly that it's not a traffic ticket that, you know, you scooted out on in a foreign country a few years previously. So, I mean, it was definitely surreal, and definitely was under the impression that there had been some sort of mix-up, some sort of mistake for a little bit, you know. It got really surreal when they arrested me, but fairly swiftly, you know, within minutes, it sunk in that this was very much a reality-based occurrence. I wasn't dreaming, you know. I pinched myself a few times, because you're supposed to, in case you're dreaming, and it hurts. So I figured out, well, this is not a dream. This is very much real. So, you know, it sank in very swiftly that something serious had happened and that they were trying to hold me responsible for this.
Did they take you in immediately for an interview? How did the process go from there? I mean, you're surprised at the airport. They take you into custody. Then what happens?
Well, they take me into custody, and they take me to the city jail in Prague, and basically waited till I could obtain a lawyer, and they said they were trying to get me to accept a court-appointed lawyer, which is never a good idea if you can afford a lawyer that you pay for, especially in something as serious as a manslaughter charge. So, you know, I sat there in jail for 8 to 10 hours. I guess I didn't have a watch. They took all that when they arrested me. Sat there and got a lawyer, and then they did my fingerprints and then carried me off to the city jail for 3 days. And they asked me to give a recollection of an evening from, you know, our show 2 years previously, about an hour and a half. It was just another show to us. So I gave my recollection to the best of my memory. And then there was a bail hearing. And they said, okay, we're going to grant you bail. It's $200,000, the equivalent thereof, in Czech crowns. And then they said, when that's paid, you know, you can go home until you're indicted, you know, if we need you back for trial. So, 3 days city jail, and then they granted me bail, and then I went off to Pancrats prison for 34 days and sat there while the whole bail fiasco got worked out.
I want to get to Pancrats prison in just a minute, because the scary factor of this whole thing going down in a foreign country had to be amplified by 1,000 when you actually got to prison. But I assume that you don't speak fluent Czech, and most of the people that are accusing you, you know, this is in a different country. They're mostly speaking a different language. I mean, did you feel like you couldn't even really understand what they were saying or what was going on?
Well, for the most part, yes. I mean, a couple of people spoke English. I wasn't, because it's a different country, different language, a different legal system, I wasn't even exactly sure of what the charge against me was. You know, I asked the woman, the head detective, she spoke some English, said, am I being charged with murder? And she said, no. I said, do you understand what manslaughter is? She said, yes, I think it's something like this. So, I mean, you know, there's varying degrees of manslaughter in the Czech criminal code or in the American code, and I wasn't exactly sure what degree I was being charged with. When I gave my testimony, I had to give it in English, and they got a state-employed translator to tell the head detective my testimony, and he was, you know, he couldn't have taught first-grade English at all. He was just, bless his heart, because he was a good guy, but he was not a good translator. So it was very frustrating trying to communicate with people in general, because nobody spoke my language, even the translator, you know, and that's what translators are supposed to do. So that was a pretty key component of the whole ordeal, was lack of communication. And I don't know, that continued on through my prison experience, you know, even something so much like trying to get stuff from the prison canteen, you know, I don't know what it is. It's labeled in Czech. But, you know, when I was in there at first, it was in the basement. So we had to put in an order. We couldn't go there until I got out in population. I could actually go to the store and at least point at things. But they gave me a shopping list when I was an intake in the basement, and it's in Czech. I can't read that. I don't know anything. You know, what does Olivaruki mean? You know, so it was quite frustrating.
So what was the prison experience like? This place, the way that you describe it in your book, just the history of this place sounds like something that you would see in everybody's worst nightmare of being trapped in a foreign prison. What was it like? First of all, just trying to get your way around, you said you went into general population, but, you know, you're with a bunch of criminals in a foreign country and you don't speak their language.
Yeah, well, you aren't cruising around the prison, you know. We were on lockdown 23 hours a day, and anytime you went anywhere in prison, you were escorted by a guard. So when I went out into population, when I say population, that means that the 1 hour a day that everybody is allowed out of the cell out to the big yard, you're still escorted everywhere. So there wasn't like, I wasn't lost in prison trying to figure my way around. Oops, I went down the wrong corridor, you know. Everything was very controlled. So the prison was 123 years old, you know. It had been there through World War II. The Nazis had it and used it as an execution ground. They had installed a guillotine, which was still there. Not still in use, but it was there as a sort of monument to the atrocities the Nazis committed while they were there. And then a bunch of people were executed there during the communist era. It's not a nice place. Parts of it they look kind of like downtown Detroit. It looks abandoned. There's broken windows, all that good stuff. And the prison, you know, itself has been, several Human Rights Watch organizations have made a stink about it because the living conditions in there are not suitable for human beings. It wasn't as bad as, like, Midnight Express, if you've ever seen that movie, a Turkish prison this guy goes to. It wasn't that horrific, but it certainly wasn't suited for human habitation. If it was in America, you know, they'd bulldoze it and build a Walmart immediately. when I was in prison, when I got out, everybody was like, was it like Midnight Express? And I had never seen the movie. So while I was awaiting my trial, I watched the movie. And I can say, no, it wasn't that bad. But it certainly didn't have all modern conveniences.
So 23 hours a day in a cell by yourself, that's a long time.
Not by myself.
So you had cellmates?
I had two cellmates, two Mongolian cellmates.
Did you try to develop any kind of rapport with these guys?
Yeah, sure. I began to teach them English. One of them spoke a little bit of English, and he was a little bit easier to communicate with, but I taught them some English, and both of them spoke Czech. So they taught me a bit of Czech, but one of them was a businessman who had, you know, he had some sort of business deal going wrong, and he really didn't belong there, I don't think. The other guy was just a drunk who had been in the Czech Republic illegally and had gotten thrown in jail for lack of a visa. And anybody can get on your nerves if you spend 23 hours a day with them in an 8x12 room. So one of my cellmates whistled incessantly, and that drove me kind of nuts towards the end. But, you know, all right, guys. I mean, it's not like we keep up or anything. It's not like, hey, remember those good old prison days we had together? You know, there's no internet in there or anything. It's not like we're Facebook buddies, right? I made some friends in prison, but, you know, most of them are still in there.
So it took over 30 days for you to get your bail cleared, and then you were allowed to be released. Is that unusually a long time? It would seem like an unusually long time.
No, not. I mean, apparently not there. You have to realize you're not in America, you know. This is an entirely different legal system. So when they granted me my bail, it was about $200,000. And my band borrowed it from our record label, and they paid it. And my lawyers told me, okay, you're going to be going home soon. They didn't put a condition on my bail so that I had to stay in the country or anything, you know, so you can go home. So I'm like, cool, I'm going to go home soon. And then all of a sudden, my lawyers told me, well, no, you're not, because the prosecuting attorney has raised an objection to your bail. And in America, if you pay bail, the judge, generally they handle all the stuff about, you know, the prosecuting attorney not wanting bail or whatever granted. They handle that before. And then once the judge grants you bail, boom, you pay it, you're out. There, the judge can grant you bail, then the prosecuting attorney can object, which he did two or three times. I paid my bail, then it was doubled, and he objected to that. So this guy really just kept the wheels of the system spinning in order to try and keep me in prison. And eventually, though, after borrowing almost $500,000, I was released. So I went home for about 6 months and then got indicted and then went back to trial.
Well, your decision to go back to trial is certainly an interesting one. But let's talk a little bit about that time where you did come home. You went right back to performing right away as soon as you made it back.
Yeah, I had to.
To pay the bills.
I'm a professional musician, and I had six lawyers by the end of my case. That stuff doesn't come free, and I make my money on tour, you know. Certainly not from record sales, because nobody buys records anymore. I'm a glorified T-shirt salesman, basically, because that's where you make your money as a professional musician. In order to pay these rather sizable legal bills, we had to go on tour and perform. So as soon as we got out, I went and did two festival shows in Iowa. 9 days, I believe, I was out of prison, and I was on stage at a festival called Knot Fest in Iowa in front of about 10,000 people. And then we did another one the next day in Wisconsin. And then about a month later, I toured the States for a while in order to pay the bills. I mean, it's a necessity. Anybody with that type of bills, you got to make money somehow. You know, lawyers ain't cheap. I mean, they certainly aren't free.
I suppose you could have been extradited back to the Czech Republic, but that's not necessarily what would have happened.
I really, you know, I don't think that the U.S. and the Czech government have a extradition agreement, the policy thing, you know. But the U.S. government wouldn't cooperate with the Czech government in any sort of investigation in the first place, because the Czech government contacted the U.S. Justice Department, said, hey, we want to investigate this dude. Then the young man died in 2010. And the U.S. government said, nope, we're not cooperating. We don't think this is warranted or whatever. I never got a solid answer out of them. But they neglected to tell me that I was going for manslaughter in another country. I'm not exactly sure about that, why that happened, you know, what the justification behind that was. But I really don't think I would have been extradited at all. You know, the evidence arrayed against me was pretty circumstantial. Regardless, I wish that the government had let me know in the first place, because even if they weren't going to cooperate with an investigation, I would have reached out on my own in order to figure the situation out. It's a pretty serious charge. It's, you know, it's not like I'm skipping out on my cable bill or something.
A lot of people would have waited for somebody else to take action once they were back in the United States, wouldn't have went back on their own free will to face these charges, because, first of all, the charges kind of seem like they're a bit of a stretch, and you don't know what's going to happen. What compelled you to go back? Why did you do it? And I'm sure that people have asked you that. I'm sure maybe even your bandmates were saying, hey, why are you doing this?
Well, because the fact of the matter is, this is a very serious situation. It's, you know, it wasn't something I could just let slide. And the other thing is that a fan of my band was dead, and the young man's parents never came at me in the court. They never badmouthed me in the press. They never came at me in private, never attacked me. They just wanted some answers as to what happened to their kid. And as far as I could tell, the best way for me to try and provide them any answers that I knew was to go and face trial. And furthermore, although I was pretty sure I certainly hadn't meant to injure this man, I never attacked him or anything, I wanted to know, what if something comes up in court? What if there's some sort of evidence that indicates that I am guilty? If that's the case, then I need to be held accountable for my actions. So to me, it seemed like the ethically responsible thing to do. The law really had nothing to do with it. I don't care about the law. I don't care about some man-made construct that says you should do this because a piece of paper says that. To me, you know, I follow my heart, and it seemed like the right thing to do, really, to try and provide this young man's family some answers the best that I could, even though I had no recollection of him whatsoever and don't to this day. And also to, you know, I need to know myself. I need to know if I have some sort of culpability in this matter. And, you know, the court system certainly is not perfect. No court system is. And it was an unfamiliar and a strange one. But it seemed like my best shot at clearing up the matter. It really seemed like the only viable option to me. So that's what I did. I went back.
Now, you didn't remember the young man that died. Did you remember a lot about that show when they were interviewing you or
nope.
during your testimony or even in your time in prison?
Nope. It was another night. It was another night at work. I do remember a few things about it because they were a bit unusual. A, it was our first time in the Czech Republic, and I normally remember the first time we ever play at the country. And B, the security, I remember it was a pretty rough show because there were kids on stage the whole show. There wasn't just one person that got on stage. There were a lot of people on stage from the beginning, from the very first song. So I remembered that. And also, after the show was done, I got a call from my publicist. A good friend of mine had died. And that was a really crappy way to end the show. You know, as soon as I was off stage, our publicist was calling me and she said, hey, my friend Paul had died. So that, you know, you normally remember where you are when you hear news that a good friend has passed away. So those are really the only things I remembered about the show. It had happened 2 years previously. We played for about 75 minutes on the stage. I mean, I ask people this a lot of the times when we talk about this. I'm like, can you tell me where you were exactly 2 years ago from 8 o'clock to 9:15 today? Most people look at me like, no, I can't.
As you mentioned earlier, you're working. You play a lot of shows.
Thousands. I've played 1,000 shows in my life. It's another day at work. It's not like they're asking me to recall what happened on my wedding night or something. You know, it's another day at work for me. So I don't remember. You know, it was another day at work. But there were a lot of different witnesses, so I need to go and hear what they had to say.
Have there been shows where you've been worried about the safety of the fans, where it looked like things might be getting out of hand?
Sure, all the time. Sure, man. And we've stopped shows before. Been like, look, we're going to stop if you guys don't start helping each other out, you know, particularly the bigger shows. And we had no problem stopping a show. We stopped a show a week ago because someone was hurt. It was one of the last shows on this last tour we just got off of.
You were acquitted of the charge that was equivalent to manslaughter. But the court, as you said, works differently, and they did level you in some way responsible. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you thought of that judgment?
Well, I think that was a way for the court to appease the prosecuting attorney. They said I was legally not responsible, but I was ethically responsible. They said that they had proved that I had pushed this young man off the stage and had killed him, but it was a security matter, but the security and nobody else did their job, as is contractually stipulated. So they said, you know, you're not legally responsible for this. This isn't your fault, but you kind of are, which I think was a great big cop out of the judgment, right? Either you're responsible or you're not responsible. Either you're guilty or you're not guilty. So I think that was some sort of attempt to appease the prosecuting attorney, who appealed the judgment anyway, immediately, twice, and was both overturned both times. But for me, as far as responsibility, I do feel I hold ethical responsibility because I should have stopped the show. Not because of anything the court says, because the court didn't prove crap. You know, the entire case was a joke. Regardless of the actual mechanics of how this young man died, I do feel that I hold some responsibility because I should have walked off stage. I should have stopped. Maybe the crowd would have rioted. Maybe, you know, they would have destroyed our tour bus. Maybe we would have had to fight a bunch of people. That's all very real possibilities that occur. I've had friends who have had to fight the audience when the show was going wrong. Regardless, I'd rather deal with any of that because if we had just said, screw this, security's not doing their job, and walked off stage, I think a young man would be alive today. So that's my take on it. As far as my view of how I view the court's judgment, I think it's a bunch of crap.
Randy Bly, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Randy Bly's memoir is called Dark Days, and it's available now. We'll be back after this. It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.